when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains descriptions of assault and murder and some animal cruelty. Listener discretion is advised.
Good morning, Joe.
Morning, Lizzie.
Now, I think today you're going to talk to us about Ned Kelly.
Ned Kelly, one of my favourite topics. I've been obsessed with Ned Kelly since I was young.
Sounds like a bit of a historical discussion.
Yes, I think so. And I think it's, you know, in some ways a bit problematic judging the events of the past by the standards of today. But I think in a legal sense, that can be useful to understand where policing and the law came from and sentencing, where it is now. So, I'm hoping that's going to be useful. Certainly, if nothing else, I hope it's interesting.
Well, I should just give you a little tidbit of information. According to my family folklore, Ned Kelly dropped in to have morning tea with my great-great-grandmother.
Wow, yes. Fantastic, in yes. The northeast of Victoria.
So, you know, be careful what you say.
Well, no, I'm a Ned Kelly supporter.
Oh, good.
Despite the fact that apparently my mother's maiden name was Scanlon, so Michael Scanlon was one of the police killed at Stringybark Creek. Apparently he's a relative.
See, we are in opposition.
There
again.
You are. Again, different signs. All right. So I probably should start with a general overview of Ned Kelly because not everybody will be familiar with him. I think probably I learned about him at school. I don't think my kids have ever done stuff on bushrangers of yours.
I know my kids had an interest, but not through school. And I learned about him. I had to learn a whole poem about him.
Oh, wow. There you go. So it seems to have dropped off the curriculum, so maybe younger people aren't as familiar. So Ned Kelly was bushranger, the head of a gang called the Kelly Gang. It had four members, Dan Kelly, his brother, Steve Hart, who was a friend of Dan's, Joe Byrne, who was then best friends with Ned Kelly. So there's the four of them, and their most famous exploits are the shootout at Stringybark Creek, where three policemen are shot dead, bank robbery at a town of Euroa, bank robbery in the New South Wales town of Jerilderie, and then 18 months later, a shootout at Glen Rowan where Joe Byrne's shot dead, Ned Kelly's shot and wounded and captured, and Steve Hart and Dan Kelly commit suicide. So this takes place in the period of the Kelly outbreak, as it's called, is between 1878 and 1880. Ned Kelly's tried, hanged on the 11th of November, 1880. So 11 November is an important day in Australian history for that reason, but also because the World War I armistice is 11 November 1918, and then Gough Whitlam was sacked 1975, 11 November.
Oh, there you go.
Yep, I always remember those things and when we celebrate Armistice Day. What most people know about Ned Kelly is a couple of things. One, he said such is life, allegedly his last words. The historical evidence is that probably weren't his last words, but certainly that's what we think that they were.
Before he got hanged.
Before he was hanged, such is life. And that the gang wore bulletproof armour, which I've always been amazed that no other bushranger or outlaw ever thought to put on bulletproof armour.
Was a wise idea.
Yeah, well, certainly it was bulletproof. I think probably some people say it was their downfall in the end because they stood in a hail of bullets, and although they weren't hitting the head and the chest, they were hitting the arms and the legs. I mean, that's how Ned Kelly was caught. They shot him in the knee, which was unprotected, and he fell over. But also I wanted really to look at his early life because I think that that is where there's the most to talk about in terms of criminal law. I mean, once they become outlaws after Stringybark Creek, it's hard to justify bank robberies, seizure at Glen Rowan, unless you look at it in a sort of a wider political context. The Kelly gang felt they were at war with the government. So assuming you're judging by the standards of a war, you might be able to justify those things. But before they become outlaws, I think there is some it's worthwhile looking at some of the things that Ned was charged with and looking at perhaps how they would have been dealt with today or whether he was dealt with unfairly by the system.
Because as far as I can recall, I mean, you just said a whole lot of things that he did wrong, yet I would say Ned Kelly has gone down in history as some kind of hero. So it doesn't really align with the idea of committing those kinds of crimes but being lauded for it.
Yeah, but I mean, in some sense, I think that's the same for, you know, Robin Hood or Billy the Kid. I mean, there's a TV series on at the moment about Billy Kid. I do think that these sort of poor people who, you know, are robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, you know, is the Robin Hood phrase. I think they do sort of go down in sort of the in our collective memories as people who should be lauded. And certainly the Kelly gang did give their money away to the rural poor, their friends and family.
You have to wonder when we think about, you know, for example, juvenile crime at the moment and the posting of themselves committing crimes on social media and getting likes, if that would have been a similar kind of reaction if there was social media back in Ned Kelly's day.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there was. I'm sure there would have been. I mean, the Kelly siege at Glen Rowan was one of the first sort of international media events that was recorded in real time. So it took so long, you know, it was quite a long siege. And so it was being reported in London before the siege had even finished.
Wow.
By the Telegraph. Yeah,
wow.
Amazing. Yeah. And certainly Ned and his friends, you know, took a level of pride in their criminality. And they talked about being flash, and they wore their straps under their noses as a particular sign of being in that group. I mean, a bit like the Eshays and them wearing particular things. And they used to wear colourful sashes and things like this, you know, to stand out and to show that they were, you know, this sort of people, I suppose, not to be trifled with, but also some level of flashiness or showiness. All right, so Ned Kelly was... His first charge that he's convicted, so he's actually charged a number of times in his early life between sort of the ages of 13 and 15. None of them proceed. So he's charged with robbery under arms, the prosecution withdraws, and he's charged, I think, with an assault on a Chinese merchant. I can't remember whether he's acquitted of that or whether it's withdrawn, but it doesn't go ahead. The first time he's charged successfully and goes to jail is two charges. One is of a vicious assault, it's called, which I thought was interesting. I wondered what the definition of vicious was because it seemed a pretty standard assault, you know, what we would call assault occasioning bodily harm now. And the other charge at the same time arising out of a related incident was obscene language.
Which still exists.
Which absolutely exists. Yeah.
Can I just ask, was he from like a criminal family? Like was he just a bad egg, or had he grown up around crime?
He certainly had. So, I mean, as you know, Lizzie, economics often plays a huge role in committing crime.
Yeah.
If you have nothing, you've got nothing to lose. So people of lower socioeconomic standing tend to be overrepresented in our jails. And certainly Ned and his relatives were poor, part of the rural poor in Victoria. And there was economic problems at the time, and the ways of they set up how they gave out land to people for farms that, you know, favoured certain people and discriminated against others. So he and his family were economically poor and really struggled to get out of that trap of being poor.
And I remember reading things that talked about his mum. Was his dad around, do we know?
Yeah, so his dad was a convict, and then when he was freed, he married his mother, who was, both of them had been born in Ireland and came out. And his father died when Ned was pretty young, I think about 12.
Right. You have to wonder what impact that had.
Yeah, I mean, fatherless families, I think there is a correlation, I haven't looked at it, between that and juvenile crime, particularly with males, yeah.
Mm. Sorry, keep going.
No. These are all interesting, interesting points. So what happens is the Kellys are poor. They often rent out a room to lodgers. So they have people lodging at the Kelly homestead. When I say homestead, it's really a hut. It's like a one-room hut with, curtains to divide up.
And rooms. The lodger would stay in the one room?
Well, it's just one large room and they divide it with curtains. So he's staying in a curtained-off room. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Very, very close and personal.
I wonder how that would go on Airbnb.
Yeah, based on some things that are on Airbnb, it probably would work. People would. So they have a lodger staying with them, a man called Gould. He's a travelling salesman, and he had got his wagon bogged in mud, and he had his horse, but his horse wasn't strong enough to pull it out. So he's staying there for a few days. Anyway, in the meantime, Ned finds a horse. Now, he knows who the owner of the horse is. Local people who live in the town, the McCormicks. It's not clear exactly whose idea it was, but someone suggests they use that horse to help the other horse to pull the wagon out of the mud. So they do. Mm-hmm. Then Ned returns the horse to the McCormicks. Now, Mr. and Mrs. McCormick then have a go at him. I'm guessing the horse was dirty and tired from doing all the work, and they accuse him of using it to pull the wagon out, which, you know, I think sort of fair cop. You've got to take that. That's what you've done. But McCormick then says that Ned's a liar and says that he could whelp Ned or any of his family.
Charming.
Yeah. And that kind of a challenge was, it's not something that Ned or I think anyone in his family, they were quite pugilistic. They were quite ready to engage in violence, would put up with. So he accepted the challenge to fight.
Oh, God.
So he says that as he's getting off the horse to fight, Mrs. McCormick smacks his horse and it jumps forward and his fist accidentally collides with Mr. McCormick's face.
Oh, classic defense.
Yes.
Oh, Lord.
So, but I think it's pretty clear that there's some kind of altercation takes place. Ned has the best of it, punches him, I think, in the face, and McCormick runs off.
And that's the vicious assault.
That's the vicious assault. Yeah, as I say, it's what we would consider a reasonably minor assault.
Yeah.
Not
okay, but relatively minor.
Well, when you say not okay, I mean, I think there's an element of provocation there. Whether being called a liar and saying, you know, you'd whelp them or their family is enough to be provocative, maybe, but certainly the other thing is a challenge. So, I mean, is it a consensual
consent
fight?
Yeah.
You know,
interesting.
If you're making threats to somebody to fight them and they go, sure, let's fight, and
Punched, so be it.
Yeah, the law won't necessarily protect you. So,
do we know what the injury was? Was it bad?
No.
No.
Yeah, that was what I found interesting. So nowadays, obviously, we categorise assaults by the level of injury.
Yeah.
So I thought when it was described as a vicious assault, oh, that's interesting. It's a,
did it break his nose? Yeah. Or, you know, like that might elevate it, but
yeah. Well, in our standards, you know, it might. Back then, I don't know, maybe it was the type of assault. Anyway, vicious assault. So. So then later that day, he and Gould are castrating calves. They're cutting their testicles off. Gould then writes an obscene note. We don't know what it said, except that it was obscene, to Mrs. McCormick, puts some of the calves' testicles in the note, gives it to Ned to send. Ned gives it to his younger, so Ned's 14, 15. He gives it to his younger cousin, Tom Lloyd, and tells Tom to deliver it.
It's like Chinese whispers.
Yeah. So Tom then delivers this to Miss McCormick. Obviously, it's obscene. That is then reported to the police along with the assault. And Ned is then charged with both these offences, obscene language and the vicious assault.
Right. Did Gould get charged for the obscene language?
No. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's interesting?
Well, because he wrote it.
Yeah.
So in a way, Ned was as much a messenger as the little cousin.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't there's a book by Ian Jones, Ned Kelly, A Short Life. I certainly recommend it to people. We'll put the name in the show notes. And that has a really good explanation of why these things turned out the way they did. But Gould's not charged. It's Ned who's charged.
Just thinking about the testicles.
Yes.
I teach one case which always causes a little bit of shock for my students when we talk about what the meaning of indecent is these days. And the official definition in Queensland of an indecent act is something that is lewd or prurient or that is an act of moral turpitude.
Yes.
And the case authority is a case of Bryant where some wallaby testicles were sent to a complainant in a jewellery box. So it seems to be not a one-off, which I thought it was.
Yeah. And certainly that definition of what is obscene can change over time based on societal...
Absolutely.
But I think sending testicles is still nowadays would be absolutely obscene.
You'd get a bit of a shock opening up that jewellery box.
Wouldn't you?
Gee. Or that letter.
So Ned's convicted. He's given 3 months for both. And it seems like it was concurrent.
Meaning to serve at the same time.
Thank you. To mean to serve at the same time. But he also got a 12-month good behaviour bond. So he had to then, once he got out, had to be of good behaviour. That comes up in the next charge that he gets charged with. So he goes to jail in November of 1870 and he, as a 15-year-old, comes out as a 16-year-old in March, late March, and that's important, of 1871. Now he gets out, he is living at home. There's another lodger who's staying at the Kelly homestead, a guy called Isaiah Wright, or Wild Wright as he used to be known, and he was a horsebreaker by trade but really a horse thief. So he turns up to the house on this beautiful mare. And stays overnight. Next morning, they can't find the mare. So the Kellys loan him a horse. He rides off to do whatever he needs to do. And I think Ned's brother-in-law finds the mare, brings it back to the Kelly homestead.
Did he find it where he'd hidden it?
I don't think they stole the horse off the horse thief. They don't know it's a stolen horse. They think he's lawfully got it.
Right.
And he's a horse breaker, so presumably Makes he can sense. Ride lots of different horses.
Yeah.
Ned, who's fresh out of jail, he has some money in his pocket. He decides he's going to shout himself. So he goes to Wangaratta, the closest sort of large town, puts himself up in the hotel, and he rides in on this beautiful horse. So, I mean, I assume it's like driving in a nice car or something.
Right.
And he says everybody sees him and the police see him. And, in fact, he meets some girls in there and he lets them ride the horse around in the yard and has a great time.
Okay.
And rides back to the town of Greta where his where the homestead is. Now, he doesn't know the horse is stolen.
Really?
Yeah, I thought you were the Ned Kelly supporter.
I am, but he sounds like a lot of coincidental things happen to him rather than, you know.
Well, based on what's happens next. So he's riding through Greta. The local police officer is this violent, dishonest, terrible policeman. He's pretty new to Greta. He was moved from his last post because he violently assaulted somebody so badly and then committed perjury in the magistrate's court, and the magistrate said you should probably move this guy out of the district. So he was then moved to Greta, which is interesting because, you know, it was a known trouble spot. The Kelly clan or the Quinns and the Lloyds, all the relatives were known sort of difficult people for the police.
It would
police.
Have been deliberate posting him there.
Well, I think it was deliberate. Yeah. And this shows the sort of the attitude the police had towards him, this guy who was, you know, quite viciously violent. Anyway, so Kelly's riding through town. Now, Hall believes, as it turns out, just on a hunch, that the horse is stolen. He doesn't actually know. It was after this put in the police gazette as a stolen horse, but not until then. At this point. He decides Kelly's on a stolen horse, probably because it was such a beautiful horse and Ned, how's this poor 16-year-old get such a great horse? But he doesn't want to say to Ned, you know, I'm going to arrest you. He says there's some papers that you need to sign for your good behaviour bond, your surety at the station. So Ned is climbing off the horse and Hall tries to grab him. Now, I probably should explain the physical differences in them. Hall, Constable Hall, is 33 years old at this point. He is over 6 foot and 16 stone, which is over 100 kilos.
Wow.
Massive man. Ned Kelly is 16 years old, 5 foot 10, so quite tall. And he weighed 11 stone, so 70 kilos.
Okay, big disparity.
Big disparity. Despite that, no, I mean, Ned Kelly goes on to be this legendary fighter and boxer, and he shows sort of examples of that in his young life. So Hall tries to grab him as he's getting off the horse. Now, Hall says that he said to Kelly, "I'm arresting you," at that point. Ned says he didn't say that. So Ned, this police officer grabs him. So Ned, there's some kind of wrestle, which ends up in Hall being thrown on the ground. Ned pushes him or trips him. Hall's on the ground.
Foolish.
Now, Ned says, "I could have if I wanted to put my foot on his neck right then and held him there." But he was concerned about his good behaviour bond.
He's just punched a police officer.
Well, he didn't punch him. Yeah,
pushed him.
Because this is interesting. So Ned makes this distinction between he felt he couldn't punch anybody because of his good behaviour. He didn't seem to have any problems wrestling people or pushing them or. So I'm not. I mean, nowadays that wouldn't.
Well, and I wonder if that comes back to that idea of consent. Like, if you're going to wrestle with someone, then it's a fair fight.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you're punching someone, I guess that is a level of malice behind that.
Well, certainly an extra level of violence.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what do you think about this? I mean, in a good behaviour bond, it seems to me that if you are even wrestling people in the street, you are potentially in breach here.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not just confined to punching people.
I mean, look, I haven't looked at these for a while, but good behaviour bonds, we in prosecution used to say it's just a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
Like they had no teeth. They didn't really, you know, they didn't really restrict anything.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of latitude, or I don't know if there still is, in carrying out that good behaviour bond.
Yeah.
So
these were the old versions, and you'd be familiar with, no doubt, where people had to pay money to be held on trust at the court.
Oh, yeah.
And if you breached your good behaviour bond, that money was forfeited. And so, of course, the Kellys don't have money themselves. They're poor, so they have to then,
fulfil it.
Yeah, they have to get some. They have to get some favors from people, and so Ned's concerned about losing their money. The other people,
okay.
So these people have been good enough to put up the surety for him.
Oh, that is a bit like Robin Hood.
It is. Mm. So he, anyway. So he's standing next to the horse. Hall's on the ground. The horse, obviously, because of the commotion, bolts. So Ned goes after the horse. So Ned says at this point, Hall says, "You're under arrest," and pulls out his Colt revolver, his police-issued gun.
Okay.
And, unbelievably, pulls the trigger.
Oh, that escalated.
Yeah, didn't it?
Gosh.
So Ned hears the click of the gun. Now, the bullet doesn't fire. It's not a misfire. It's just the bullet just doesn't work.
Oh.
And so Ned stops and turns around. I mean, what is your – you said that escalated, but what's your view of that in terms of somebody's fleeing from police custody? What are the police allowed to do?
Well, I mean, fleeing from police custody does entitle a police officer to use a higher level of force. And, in fact, if we think about shooting someone or, I guess, tasering someone, if they're escaping or trying to escape from custody – that is, in particular circumstances, lawful for the police to do.
I'm not sure shooting will be. I mean, tasering, because that's a non-lethal.
I think it's section 616 of the Police Powers Responsibilities Code in Queensland. So 615 says you can only use reasonably necessary force,
yes,
not amounting to death or GBH.
Yes.
But 616 says you can use potentially lethal force, which would have to include shooting someone.
Sure, if
someone is trying to escape from lawful custody. That's really one of the provisions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So he fires. Okay. Let's assume that at that point it's legal. I think it's an overreaction, but.
Well, and Ned's not armed,
he's
not threatening the police. And so if you even think about the ability to use potentially lethal force, it has to be, you know, it has to meet the criteria for why you had to do that. Like, why couldn't the police officer just chase after him?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He wasn't under threat.
Yeah. So Ned then stops, turns around, Hall gets up, walks towards him with the pistol, pulls the trigger three more times.
What?
Yes. Each time it misfires. Unbelievably. Yeah.
Bit like the ankle monitors that they spent all the money on and they didn't quite work.
They didn't work, yes. So the police issued cop, well, certainly the bullets in it didn't work. But I mean, it's got six shots. So Ned's there. He says he's shaking in fear. Police officer advancing on him, pulling the trigger on his police issued revolver.
Wow.
So Ned obviously, it's like a game of Russian roulette. At what point is one of these bullets going to go off? So when the police officer is close enough, Ned jumps on him and they wrestle for the gun. So Ned obviously decides, I'm not going to wait to see what bullets five and six do. I'm going to try and get the gun on him. So then there's a wrestle to get the gun. Now, unbelievably, Ned is a 16-year-old who, with a 30-kilo weight disadvantage, has the better of the wrestle. And he is on top of Hall trying to wrench the gun out of his hand. Constable Hall then calls out for assistance and some local shopkeepers, like the butcher and the blacksmith or whatever.
Candlestick maker.
A couple of candlestick maker. Greta was known for its candlesticks. They come out of their shop and they grab Ned and they restrain him and they tie him up. So Hall then gets off the ground and it gets even worse. He then comes over to Ned, who is tied up and being held by these men, and hits him in the head with the butt of his revolver as hard as he could, and that's what Hall said he did. That's not what he said. I hit him as hard as I could, four or five times in the head.
Wow.
Hall says he did that as a justification for sort of restraining it, because he didn't mention in his report that Ned was tied up at that stage.
Of course not.
And he tried to say he was trying to knock him unconscious. Anyway, he doesn't knock him unconscious, unbelievably, but he certainly stuns him badly and puts an enormous gash in his head so that when the family arrive in town, they can follow the blood trail back to the police station.
Wow.
He gets 9 stitches in his head. He's got a scar on his head for the rest of his life.
But seriously, he had an angel on his shoulder that day.
Oh, didn't he? Unbelievable.
Well, I don't want to interrupt the flow of the story, but, I mean, that idea of which I would call that police brutality. And I really want to say at the outset that we are probably going to talk today about police doing the wrong thing, which is not something that we can deny. It happens. But I also want to say that I am, you know, very much in support of police generally. Like I don't want this to just become a police bashing exercise. I think in any, you know, group there will be bad apples, and I think that we can definitely point to many instances where police have done wrong. But overall, I think our police are not appreciated enough. Like, I think they do put their lives on the line and they do really a hard job with not a lot of recognition or gratitude. And my 16-year-old has wanted to be a police officer since he was 2, and he is, you know, really keen to do that, and I support him in that. But I worry, because it's a really tough profession to undertake. So I just want that on the record.
No, well, I think it's important to say, I mean, the police officers do a very difficult job.
Amazing.
It's one of the few jobs where you could go to work and it's a possibility that you won't come home at the end of the day. I mean,
and we've seen that happen in recent times.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, we're going to, well, I've got examples of police misconduct and they're all from the media, but people aren't interested in reading the acts of heroism so much.
Yeah.
It's where there is things that you can be critical of that really garner the attention. So it's not a fair reporting of police conduct overall.
Yeah. I should also say that the standards of the people they allowed into the police force in Victoria in the 1870s was pretty low, considering some of the people who are the police officers. They're, you know, barely better than the people that they're arresting.
Right.
And corruption was a problem in the Victorian police force at this time. And at the end of, so Ned Kelly's hanged in November of 1880. In 1881, there is a royal commission into the causes of the Kelly outbreak, and it looks at the police misconduct.
Wow.
And identifies, you know, a number of problems about how the police handled the Kellys and the whole situation that really, you know, were causative of the.
And were any of the police officers charged?
I don't think anyone was charged. People resigned and left the force. Yeah, and
so this bashing of Kelly on this day did Were there any consequences for...
No consequences for Constable Hall. He...
And that still rings true today, yeah, in a lot of cases.
He... So at the subsequent trial, he says Ned was on a stolen horse. Ned proves that he was in jail when the horse went missing.
Oh, gosh.
And so they then charge him with receiving a stolen horse. Now, I don't actually have much of a problem with that because, I mean, you would have seen this as a prosecutor. If you can't prove that, if you know the property's stolen and you can't prove they stole it, you charge with receiving. That's a pretty standard.
Yeah, it's always an alternative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he gets charged with receiving a stolen horse. Now, the question then becomes, well, how did Hall know the horse was stolen? Because it wasn't reported. So it wasn't published in the Police Gazette until after he had detained Ned.
He's just a very good investigator. Well,
he purges himself. He said, I read it in the Police Gazette.
Oh.
And then they proved that the Police Gazette came out.
Okay, I was trying to find a way out for him there. No.
But one of the other important things, I think this is important for when we get to discussion of Stringybark Creek, is this idea of this guy shooting at Ned or attempting to shoot Ned in circumstances where Ned was unarmed and was not a threat and was just standing still. Because later on at Stringybark Creek, Ned is very concerned that the police are not going to ask him to surrender. As soon as I see him, they're just going to shoot him dead.
Fair.
So, and you can understand why you'd think that when, as a 16-year-old boy, a grown police officer was pulling the trigger and trying to shoot you.
But, and you know what that makes me think of? So, sidebar.
Yep.
This idea of an unarmed.
Yes.
Well, and okay, so I'm thinking of the woman in the nursing home who was tasered and she died. This was in 2023, so just last year. So a 95-year-old great-grandmother, she was holding a steak knife in her little nursing home she was in.
Yes, and advancing, wasn't she?
She was approaching with the aid of her walking frame.
Right.
And the 33-year-old senior constable pulled his taser out and he tasered her once in the chest and a second time in the back just to ensure that she didn't pose him or anyone else a threat.
Yeah.
So she fell to the ground, the 95-year-old. She fractured her skull and she spent the rest of her days in hospital receiving end-of-life care and she died a week later.
And that police officer has now been charged.
So he's been charged with three assault offences.
Wow, okay.
That's the charge.
Yeah.
Because she died as a result of his actions, there was public demand, I think, for more serious charges to be laid. But so you read that, and what it does is foster this idea that...
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There is no time for surrender. You know, like, it's like the police sort of act now and justify after.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's 2023.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, I think probably these kind of arrest and detaining people are some of the most difficult situations police deal with.
Yes.
I accept that. And you're having to make split-second decisions.
And the whole suicide by cop.
Yes.
Which, you know.
We might need to explain that for people, suicide by cop.
So people who make a decision to aggravate or threaten police with the idea that they will be
shot dead
as a consequence. I mean, what that must do to the police officers mentally. Like it's the worst scenario you can picture. But, I mean, that happens as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think the example of the 95-year-old grandma, great-grandmother, and, you know, Ned Kelly, 16-year-old, unarmed, standing still, I mean, are two occasions where the force use was just not warranted at all.
No.
So he goes off to jail and he does 3 years hard labour for that. And he's very annoyed, understandably, by that. He gets out and he then goes straight, as it were. So he gets out in, what are we talking, 1871? No, that's wrong. 1874 he gets out. And the next thing that occurs, the Fitzpatrick incident, which starts the Kelly outbreak, that doesn't occur till 1878. So he has a period where he works in a sawmill and he works for a stonemason. And his employers love him. They say he's fantastic. He's a hard worker. All of the men love him. But he gets to a point where he feels the police harassment on his family was such that he just couldn't win. And so he did what would make him more money, which was horse and cattle stealing. Because he was an excellent horseman. He knew all of the, he lived he was a great bushman. So he knew all of the, how to survive in the bush and all the, you know, backtracks to get places. And so he and a group and a gang began stealing horses in Victoria, taking them to New South Wales, across the Murray River, changing their brands, selling them, stealing horses in New South Wales, taking them across the Murray River, changing their brands and selling them.
Right.
And it was a very, very successful operation. But the police are onto them, and the police have this large sort of task force tracking these horse thieves. And they're pretty sure they know who they are, and they're building a case. And it reminded me of the kind of investigation that I see now in terms of drug production and drug,
right.
and trafficking.
Yes.
Drugs obviously weren't a huge feature in 19th century policing. So it seemed to me that horse cattle stealing was the 19th century version of what we would see as our sort of drug task force.
Not quite as lethal.
No. They get enough evidence to arrest Dan Kelly or to issue an arrest warrant for him for horse stealing. And a young constable, Alexander Fitzpatrick, he's not particularly well liked. He's lazy. He's a drunkard. He decides, presumably, that he's going to put himself in the good graces of his superiors by arresting Dan Kelly. So he goes by himself to the Kelly homestead at night.
Stupid.
Well, not only was it stupid, it was against a police order which said police shouldn't go to the Kelly homestead alone. Gave himself some Dutch courage. He went to the pub beforehand. So he turns up and he's drunk. Now, exactly what happens is a matter of debate. Certainly we know that Dan Kelly was there, and there is a description of a discussion. Dan Kelly comes to the door and Alexander Fitzpatrick says he's got an arrest warrant. Dan Kelly says, I'm just having my dinner. Can you wait? Fitzpatrick goes into the homestead. I mean, police wouldn't do that nowadays at all.
No.
They had an arrest warrant. You'd be straight to the station. Anyway, so they're sitting around the kitchen table. Dan's eating.
The police officers,
yeah.
Sitting there.
Sitting at the table.
Hilarious.
Now then Ned tells a story, which is probably true, that Mrs. Kelly, who was pretty formidable, says, why are you here? And Fitzpatrick says, there's a warrant for Dan Kelly's arrest. And Dan says, well, show me the warrant. And he says, well, I haven't seen the warrant. I've just seen a telegram. And Mrs. Kelly says, well, you can't take him if you can't produce the warrant.
Which is still the case.
Well, you can't take him if the warrant doesn't exist. I think you don't have to have – you can act on the orders of someone else, can't you, for an arrest?
Well
– and you can do a warrantless arrest.
You can do a warrantless arrest. There's still some concern about acting on – orders of a superior, in Queensland at least,
yeah.
Without knowledge of the matter yourself,
yeah.
And forming your own reasonable suspicion. So there is a limit to exercising the power under those circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you are going to exercise any kind of warrant in Queensland, whether it's a search warrant or an arrest warrant, one of the first things is to provide the warrant to the person involved.
Certainly searches, yeah, absolutely. That's the first thing they do. They say, here's the warrant.
That's right.
So now exactly what happens next or how this all panned out is a matter of conjecture, and historians argue about it. There is a pretty long-standing story that Alexander Fitzpatrick, who was a ladies' man, he was a Lothario.
And a drunkard.
He'd
what
already,
a catch.
I know, what a catch. Well, he'd already got one woman pregnant and hadn't married her, and he was going with another one. Anyway, so the story is that Kate Kelly, who is 14 and the looker of the family.
Oh, dear.
The idea is that he makes some kind of a pass at her. Whatever happens, there's some kind of melee then takes place. He says he's hit in the head with a fry pan by Mrs. Kelly.
Fair.
Fair. He says that Ned Kelly then comes in and fires three shots. Ned Kelly with two other men come in, fire three shots. One of them hits Fitzpatrick in the wrist.
Ooh.
Now, Ned Kelly at first said he wasn't even there, and he pointed out that Ned Kelly was a noted crack shot.
I thought you were going to say a noted liar.
And absolute crack shot. And he said, why would I shoot three times in a house full of my brothers and sisters? Because in the house, I should say, Mrs. Kelly's got a three-day-old baby. I think she's got a two-year-old, a four-year-old, and then there's the older Kelly children, 12, 14.
I thought the dad died.
It's a second marriage.
Oh, okay.
So she's got three kids to her second marriage, and then she's got her older Kelly children.
That poor woman.
I know. So whatever happens, Fitzpatrick escapes. He does actually have a wound to his hand.
It's a bullet wound?
There was no bullet in it, but it was a small wound, and so they said that Ned Kelly was said, he did it himself with a pocket knife. But the best historian in Australia on Ned Kelly, Ian Jones, says he thinks actually Ned did shoot him because Ned had this particular gun, really old-fashioned thing, which shot little balls and not that powerful. And he said that's the kind of wound it probably would have made.
Right.
So,
he learnt from the police, shoot first, talk later.
Well, what happened, Ian Jones says he thinks this happened. There's some melee going on in the house. Ned is outside and hears it, comes in, fires the gun over the head of Fitzpatrick as a warning at exactly the moment Fitzpatrick puts his hands up to surrender because he sees Ned Kelly with a gun, hits him in the wrist. Anyway, we don't know what happened, but the upshot of it all was then that warrants are issued for attempted murder against Ned and Dan, but also against Mrs. Kelly.
What?
And these two other men, one of them mistakenly identified who wasn't even there. Yeah, so Ned and Dan take to the hills. They've got a little hut on Bullet Creek, which is up in the Wombat Ranges, and they go there.
Aptly named?
Wombat Ranges.
Bullet Creek.
Oh, Bullock, sorry.
Oh, Bullock.
Bullock Creek. Bullet Creek. They so Mrs. Kelly presumably doesn't think anything's going to happen besides the fact she's got all these young kids. The police turn up the next day and arrest her. She then spends the next...
What about her baby?
The youngest goes with her. The two-year-old and the four-year-old are then raised by their older half-sisters, the Kelly sisters.
How long did she go to jail for?
She gets 3 years hard labour.
What?
Yes. Well, it's
is that for the fry pan?
No, that's for attempted murder. What do you think?
What,
of that?
As a party?
Yeah.
So they said she was a party to Ned shooting Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
What did she do to aid?
Well, hit him with a fry pan. I don't know.
Wow. But she did that before Ned Kelly even came in.
Yeah. So you're just to try and unpack this for people listening. Your query is. Although
on what
she
basis?
Might, yeah, on what she's guilty, she might be guilty of assault, but she doesn't have any knowledge that Ned's going to try.
No,
and, yeah.
So to be under our party provisions, which are where you can be liable for an offence you haven't committed yourself,
You
have to show that they did something to aid.
Yep.
And aiding can be encouragement, but is there any evidence that she said shoot him or anything like that?
Maybe standing there with a fry pan in hand after you just
Well, passive presence
passive
at
presence.
The scene of a crime is categorically not
provided
enough.
Provided your presence doesn't encourage the offender.
Yeah, but if so she's just there.
Yeah. Anyway.
I find that
What do you think about 3 years, though, for attempted murder of a police officer?
Well.
That seems a bit
if
short
that
to
was,
me.
If it was a fair charge, then I think that's a very light sentence.
Isn't it? But I do too, but they have hard labour, which I think we don't have that anymore.
No.
And I wonder how that would change. I'm assuming now we give higher head sentences, maximum sentences, because we don't have this ability to make your life in jail
miserable.
More difficult. Well, I think we do make people's lives miserable, but
physically,
yes. So,
I'm just still thinking about that little baby.
Well, it is with her in jail
the
but
whole
even,
time.
But even worse, her other baby, Ned, she then sees him once more before he dies, and that is in the week before he dies. They let her go in and see him, and then he's hanged later. So she's in jail for the whole of the outlawry.
Wow.
The other two men get 6 years each, and they do the full six.
Even the misidentified one?
Mm.
What?
I tried to prove that he wasn't there because he had alibis, and I think the jury just didn't believe his alibis.
That would have been a good case for you to do.
I know. I'd have loved that case.
Total miscarriage of justice.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that occurs in, when are we talking? 1878, that's it, April. 1878 now, so we're 7 years after his...
release.
No, well, we're sort of, 4 years after? Oh, anyway, he's released in 74, 4 years after his release. He's released in 1874 from his horse stealing, and now he's... he's
murder.
Yeah, so he's on the run. There's a warrant for his arrest. It's not till after the trial in October of 1878 that the police make a really concerted effort to try and find them. So they get two police parties together, two police posses, and they leave from different towns and they head into the Wombat Ranges because they know that's where they are. Now, Ned on the grapevine hears this, and he hears that some of the police are saying they're not going to ask Ned Kelly to surrender, they're just going to shoot him as soon as they see him.
Is that corroborated now? Like, was that the attitude?
Well, I don't know what the Royal Commission, if it even looked into that. I can certainly say this, the amount of guns and ammunition that the party that Ned comes across at Stringybark Creek is pretty phenomenal. Right. I mean, they didn't just each have their service revolvers. They had shotguns, they had rifles, they had tons of ammunition. So Ned said it looked like they didn't look like they didn't mean to kill me, they meant to riddle me. So
right.
And based on what's happened with Constable Hall, I think he can feel, you know, a little justified that the police might actually shoot him without asking him to surrender.
Yeah.
So he decides the only thing they can do. So there's this pincer movement of these two police parties. Now, the police don't exactly know where they are. And in fact, the camp at Stringybark Creek is quite close to Bullock Creek, where the Kellys have their hut. So close that the Kellys hear the gunfire. Hear the gunfire because the police are shooting birds to eat.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why didn't they pack food?
Well, I suppose they did, but not fresh meat. I mean, this is before vac packing. Yeah. So they decide the only thing that they can do is go down, hold them up, bail up the police, and then take all their guns and then disappear over the border to New South Wales. So that's the plan. So they go down, and it is just coincidence that Joe Byrne and Steve Hart happen to be there, because lots of people of their friends were visiting him at Bullock Creek. But on this particular day, it's Steve Hart, Dan Kelly's friend, Joe Byrne, Ned's friend. And they all go down and they creep up. And
just the four of them.
Just the four of them. Yeah. They see the police camp, watch it for a while. They can see two police officers. They think the other two police are in the tents. After a while, they call out, bail up, throw up your arms. And they stand up there and so that people can see them. Now, the two police officers there, one's Lonigan and one's McIntyre. McIntyre immediately puts his hands up. Lonigan grabs a rifle, runs several metres, jumps behind a log, comes up. Ned says Lonigan was aiming at him. Ian Jones, the historian, says he thinks Lonigan was actually aiming at Dan Kelly. Whatever the upshot, Ned shoots Lonigan. You can only see his head, but as I said, he's a crack shot, shoots him in the eye, kills him.
Kills him.
Yeah. And he says, I shot him, otherwise he would have shot me, or he would have shot Dan Kelly. So okay. That sounds like a pretty straight-up case of self-defense, assuming, you know, taking away that they're police officers acting in their lawful duty.
Yes,
if somebody points a gun at you, you don't have to wait for them to shoot. You can shoot them first.
Yeah, but you're discounting a huge part of it being that they were police officers.
Yeah. A police officer acting outside of their duty
Their duty was to go and...
arrest them.
And if they felt under threat, then they're entitled to defend themselves.
Yeah. Sure.
Ooh, sticky.
So Ned then goes into the camp. Lonigan's dead. They have McIntyre. They then are with McIntyre for an hour or so. McIntyre says the other two police officers, Scanlon and Kennedy, are away. They're looking. They've gone looking for you. Kelly knows Lonigan. He'd been in a punch-up with Lonigan before. And Lonigan was one of the officers saying he was going to shoot Ned and not ask him to surrender.
Yeah.
So in some sense, Ned doesn't have any... No, there's no tears for Constable Lonigan.
Mm.
He doesn't know McIntyre. He doesn't know Kennedy. He doesn't know Scanlon. They're from different parts of the district, so he's never met them. And he says, I don't have any problems with any of you. I appreciate you doing your lawful duty, but you've got two... They look at all the guns and they're like, you're clearly serious. Here. Yeah. And so he says to McIntyre, we'll go back and hide in the bushes. We're going to keep you under surveillance. When the others come back, you get them to surrender. The others come riding back through the bush. McIntyre says, the Kellys have us surrounded. You need to surrender. The other two, Kennedy and Scanlon, think it's a joke. Scanlon starts unslinging his rifle. Ha, 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 ha. The Kellys all stand up. Well, the gang stands up, says, bail up, throw up your arms. They realize it's not a joke. Kennedy immediately jumps off his horse and has his horse between them and the gang.
Poor horse.
Yeah. And starts firing. Scanlon, who's on the horse, has a rifle on his shoulder. He's unslinging it. As he's unslinging it, he fires it at Ned. Wide, shoots wide, doesn't hit anybody. Ned fires back. Now, Ned says he was the one who shot Scanlon, but I think he was probably taking all the historians think he was probably taking the rap for Joe Byrne, who's effectively beside Scanlon, because Scanlon's wound is in his side, in his chest, and he gets shot.
Right.
He does get hit, I think, in the shoulder. Anyway, he then is shot and falls on his horse, dies. So then there's McIntyre and Kennedy. McIntyre jumps on Kennedy's horse and rides off.
Sensible.
Well, sensible. Ned says, I could have shot him if I wanted to. And, I mean, he's a pretty crack shot. He probably could have. He doesn't. He lets him ride away. Kennedy is firing at them, so they fire back. Kennedy is retreating back through the bush, and Ned is going after him firing. The others come up behind. Ned fires and hits Scanlon in the shoulder, doesn't realize, knows he's hit him, but doesn't realize that the shot means Kennedy drops his gun. Kennedy runs to the next tree, blood pouring down his arm into his hand, steps out from behind the tree trying to surrender, trying to put his hands up. Ned sees something dark in his hand, which turns out to be blood, fires again, hits him in the chest, drops Kennedy.
Can I ask, was he running backwards when he was shot in the shoulder, or did Ned fire into his back?
No, he was behind a tree firing at Ned, and shot him in the shoulder.
Right.
And then Kennedy was retreating backwards up.
Backwards.
He was running from tree to tree, but back up the hill to try and get away from them. And Ned's advancing on him firing.
Like, picturing it in my head, it is not looking good for Ned, I've got to say.
No, sure. I think this is, and this is the killing that I find most problematic.
Mm.
They run up to Kennedy. They, as they're running up, they see that his pistol's nowhere near him. He dropped it, you know, and they realize he was unarmed. They feel terrible. They see, you know, it's just in the heat of the moment, you know, snap decision, fire, and they hit him. He's still alive.
Oh, geez.
But they know that they've got to leave because the police are going to be on them. He's that badly injured, he's not going to survive. And so what do?
Did they shoot him?
So Ned shoots him and kills him.
Right.
And so that idea of this mercy killing, killing somebody who's going to die anyway, you know, effectively putting them out of their misery, that's something which is, I think, well, I mean, is it morally problematic? Because, you know, you are killing somebody and you are deliberately causing the death. I mean, it's a murder. Well,
and he could have stayed and tried to staunch the wound. You don't know that. But he wanted to save himself. So the choice he made was, oh, well, I'll do it this way instead. But he had another option.
Well, I mean, I'm no medical expert, but the people who were there who had presumably seen gunshot wounds before were pretty convinced that he was not going to survive.
But maybe that a couple served of hours
lying there. He, in the end, he wasn't found for another 3 days. I mean, he wasn't going to survive 3 days. Took the police 3 days to make it there and find.
Well, he wasn't going to survive 3 days without any attention, but who knows what could have been done if he'd had some kind of aid from the Kellys. But they didn't want to get caught, which, I mean, I understand that, but I don't know that we can say it's not morally problematic.
I think it is morally problematic. I think it is.
Yeah, good. I do too.
I certainly don't think it's justified. But, I mean, that idea of mercy killing is not a new idea.
No. And, look, a little bit different, but, again, sidebar, but just in 2022 there was a guy in Cairns who was paid $5,000 to cut off another man's leg, and it happened in a public park. Like it was
on, oh my Lord.
It was on CCTV footage. I've got a friend who's a police officer up there, and he saw it. And clearly it didn't go well.
No. So was it from the knee down? Please tell me it was.
No, I think it was quite high.
Wow.
And you could see the guy who'd cut off the leg then dragging the leg, and the guy whose leg was cut off crawling for a little short moment before he died, like he died from that. And he's been charged with the death, obviously, even though he was paid, was doing it at the request of the victim.
Mm.
But I guess it's, you know, a different motivation, but still this idea where it's not a murder out of malice. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that was recent. Yeah. Like these things.
Yeah. You know. I mean, Kennedy didn't want to be shot. I think he said, don't shoot me.
Oh.
No shot.
Well, this guy, can I just tell you, but the guy who asked for his leg to be cut off, they said that he had some issue with his body image.
Oh, wow.
And thought he'd be better off without the leg.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't a fair request.
No. But, I mean, you can't consent to grievous bodily harm being done on you anyway.
No, consent's irrelevant.
Yeah.
But I guess if you're looking at the motivation behind the crime in a mercy killing or something like that where he was requested to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a defense.
No.
But it's a different level of culpability mentally.
Yeah. I was thinking about this in World War One. There's a story at Passchendaele, you know, on the Western Front. You know, it's mud and really dangerous mud that you get sucked into. And there's a guy in no man's land who is stuck in the mud up to his neck, can't get out, they can't pull him out.
Oh.
And he is just dying over the course of a number of days, begging people to shoot him.
And they did?
Well, it's unclear, but because the story just isn't finished, but I think that they might have, yeah.
I read a thing from the US, it was from 2006, so it's old now, but it was about killings in combat circumstances and how there was a suggestion through a research paper that if someone does a mercy killing in a combat context, that the soldier who does the mercy killing shouldn't be charged with premeditated murder because of the circumstances leading to that offence and the consequences for those army people. And I think even though 2006 now is nearly 20 years ago, like that's not that ancient history.
No.
And for that to still arise as a...
Yeah. Well, I suppose you're in a combat zone, you get injured very badly.
Yes.
You know there's no way that they can get medical assistance to you. You know you're going to die.
I know.
You know you don't want to be captured because you might be killed by the enemy or tortured.
And so there obviously are examples of mercy killings, but then those soldiers were being charged with premeditated murder.
Yeah.
So it's a really tough one.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. So Ned and the gang then escape. And they are then declared outlaws, which is something we don't have nowadays, but you are then outside the law. You're entitled to be killed, shot on sight.
Is that what it means?
Yeah, no legal protections apply to you. Yeah.
Wow.
Outlaw, you're outside of
the law. So when we say outlaw motorcycle gangs... We don't mean that kind of outlaw.
No, we mean that... I suppose we're just saying it in that sort of sense that they're very bad. But
right.
Yeah, it traditionally meant you were outside the law. So,
wow.
Yeah, unbelievable. And then they go on, the gang then goes on to commit these two bank robberies. Nobody else is shot in the two bank robberies, completely violence-free. They hold up a station and then rob the bank at Uri. They hold up the entire town of Geraldine.
Oh, my God.
I know. Well, not the entire. I mean, they take over the hotel, they take over the police station, they take over. Nobody gets shot. Some of the most successful bank robberies in Australian history, and they get away with what in today's money is millions and millions of dollars.
Really?
Yeah, which is never
Where
found.
Did it, oh.
It gets distributed amongst all their sympathisers and their supporters.
Really?
Yeah. So, and then they have the siege at Glen Rowan, which is a whole story in itself I won't go into. But as I say, I think it's hard to justify those behaviours because by that stage, you know, how do you justify robbing a bank? I mean, that's hard, unless you look at it in a political context. But in a legal context, it's pretty strata them down.
Yeah.
So that's why I wasn't really going to look at that. I just wanted to look at these early ones where, you know.
Well, and it does make you ask, if he hadn't been treated like that in his early years, would his story have gone the way it did? And I think you can draw parallels to current policing. You know that there's profiling done by police. You know that there are certain offenders or groups of offenders who do get targeted. And you can see why those types of people, A, don't have any respect for the law, and B, do the things they do because regardless, they're going to come to police attention one way or another. So I think maybe Ned Kelly would have always become an outlaw, but don't know that.
No. Certainly some people felt that in another context he would have been a great man, because he was so talented.
Yeah.
But he certainly felt that it was the police behaviour towards him and his family that caused his outlawry. And he said, so when he was in prison waiting execution, he wrote a number of letters or gave interviews and to the media. Yeah. And in one of them he says this, and I thought it was something we might end with. He says, "If my life teaches the public that men are made mad by bad treatment, and if the police are taught that if they may not exasperate to madness, men they pursue and ill-treat, my life will not be entirely thrown away. People who live in large towns have no idea of the tyrannical conduct of the police in country places far removed from the court. They have no idea of the harsh and overbearing manner in which they execute their duty or how they neglect their duty and abuse their powers."
Wow.
Yeah.
I know you want to end on that, but can I just finish on a little story? So the friend of mine who I just mentioned who's a police officer in Cairns, he started his career as a police officer in Surfers Paradise, and it was a really tough place to be a police officer, and an opportunity came up for him to take a position in Blackwater, a little country town.
Yep.
So this does go against what Ned Kelly said there. But he told me about the first arrest he effected when he was in Blackwater. And he said that in Surfers Paradise, if you're going to arrest someone, there's a process. And I think colloquially it's called beasting. So you get them on the ground, you pull their arm up behind them so you can cuff them, and then they're under control. So he had to arrest this fellow in Blackwater, and he did that. He got him on the ground and he pulled his arm up ready to cuff him. And he said the guy on the ground sort of just turned his head and goes, "You're new, aren't you?" And the other police officer he was on duty with said, "Mate, you can just ask him to hop in the back of the van." So, I mean, there is definitely a difference.
I think that's right. Nowadays, I think the policing in the country areas, you know, small area, you know, they tend to know the population. I think in some ways it can be better than policing in metropolitan areas.
But say that, you know.
But certainly that idea that men are made mad by bad treatment, I've always remembered that, and it strikes me so often in criminal law that the way that people are treated by the police and just by the system generally can often, you know, lead to more problems.
And look, a whole other episode perhaps, but I come back to my really strong feeling when it comes to juveniles that, you know, incarcerating them and this reform to build a new prison for juveniles and hold them in watch houses, I think once you're in that system, it is so difficult to break away from it. And so we're not creating, but we're allowing not rehabilitation in any way, but this building on whatever issues were there in the first place. And they become accustomed to it, professionals, they have contact with other criminals, and that kind of sentences them to a life on that path.
And I mean, the sad thing is that's a lesson that we could have been learning from the 1880s in Victoria.
Isn't that crazy?
And we're probably still not learning. Anyway, but Ned Kelly, hero or villain?
Oh, well, now I'm more torn than I was at the start. I think he maybe started as a hero, but perhaps he ended as a villain. I don't like that shooting.
I don't either. I find that problematic. Anyway, I
suppose. So interesting, Joe. Who would have thought crimes from the 1800s would grab your attention like that?
Lovely. All right. Well, thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.